This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
It's been 10 years since Bill Bowie and Francesca Rhiannon launched Sea Change Radio in Western Massachusetts. To celebrate this past decade of broadcasts, we're looking back at some of the best moments and interviews. This week, we've dug up some highlights from the first 5 years of the show, featuring guests as diverse and dynamic as Wangari Maathai, Barney Frank, Francis Moore LePay, Ken Burns, Van Jones, John Perry Barlow, and Ralph Steadman. This is Alex Wise, and you're listening to Sea Change Radio. To celebrate a decade of broadcasts, let's start out with a small piece from Bill Bowie and Francesca Rhiannon's 2008 interview with noted author and researcher Francis Moore LePay, who talks about fear of scarcity and where this fear can lead us.
You know, of all the books of yours that I've read, including Diet for a Small Planet, which completely changed my life, this one, Getting a Grip, is really my favorite.
Oh, my goodness.
It is. It is just a wonderful book that really kind of brings together a whole philosophical framework of hope that is also very practical. Why did you call it Getting a Grip?
Well, I call it Getting a Grip because I believe that we will feel pretty useless unless we understand, at least have a working theory of how do we get into this mess to begin with. So getting a grip to me means getting a grip on the roots, going deeply, deeply to the historical, psychological, all any way you want to cut it, get to the root of the problem. And so I'm starting with the premise that the root is very much in our heads, if you will. It's in the ideas that we hold about reality that tell us that there's not enough. We live in a frame of fear, a fear of scarcity. There's not enough to go around, and there's not enough goodness inside us. We don't see reality unfiltered. We see reality all around us every day through filters that we create as cultures. And they then tell us what's possible, basically, what human nature is, and therefore what we're capable of. And so if our frames, I call this filters, our frames or our mental maps, my daughter and I call them in Hope's Edge, if they are faulty, then we can't dig ourselves out of the world predicament. So I'm asking that we get a more realistic mental map, one that acknowledges the potential for human cruelty and one that acknowledges also the potential for great, you know, common purpose.
Next, we hear Bowie and Rhiannon in 2008 discuss global warming and rapid melting of polar ice caps with environmental thinker and founder of the World Watch Institute, Lester Brown.
One of the things that's happening is, as you go to subsequent versions, is that the urgency is increasing. And you also say that each of us has a leading role to play. How do you get folks to wrap their heads around the urgency and recognize their part?
Just over a year ago, in August and September of 2007, there was a flurry of reports on ice melting from the scientists who were tracking the Arctic sea ice, and they pointed out that in 1 week, an area of Arctic sea ice the size of the United Kingdom had disappeared. And they had just never seen Arctic sea ice melt at that rate before. And then there were reports from Greenland of melting on a scale that scientists, again, had never seen before. The glacial outflows from the Greenland ice sheet through the coastal valleys into the Atlantic. And they were looking particularly at a glacial outflow called the Ilulissat Glacier. That must be an Inuit name. And then there was melting of the glaciers in the Himalayas and on the Tibetan Plateau. And these are the glaciers whose ice melt sustains the major rivers of Asia during the dry season. Without these glaciers, many of the rivers in Asia would become seasonal rivers, like the Yangtze or the Yellow, for example. So when you look at climate change, you really don't have to go beyond ice melting to see that as a civilization, we're in trouble. If the Greenland ice sheet goes, sea level rises 23 feet, and we'd have to redo all the world's maps in a way that we can hardly imagine right now.
In his time in Congress, Barney Frank was known as one of the more prickly politicians to interview. Here in this snippet from 2008, Frank doesn't disappoint, as he responds to a fairly straightforward question about fiscal policy from Bill Bowie with a crotchety tour de force.
Representative Frank, you're saying that these haven't been on the table or haven't been in the law. You've been the head of the House Financial Services Committee for the last 2 years. What is it that you have done and what have you not done to make sure...
Well, I'm surprised, frankly, that you're so interested in this that you don't know more about it. I would say before you get accusatory, I would do a little more research. In fact, Say on Pay passed the House last year. Our committee voted it. It unfortunately hasn't been acted on in the Senate. Secondly, we've been putting a lot of pressure on the SEC to try to reform the proxy access, and we had been trying to get legislation on that. We were blocked. But on Say on Pay in particular, the House passed a bill to mandate it, mandate that there be a shareholder vote on compensation, and it was unfortunately held up in the Senate. And it is true. I became the chairman a year and a half ago. We've done other things. Last year, we passed a bill to ban the kind of abusive subprime loans that have been problematic. We also passed a bill that the Republicans hadn't been able to do in 12 years, significantly to improve the regulation of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. The House passed that in May of 2007. The Senate, unfortunately, didn't get around until July. So in those three areas, increasing the regulation of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and Say on Pay, we did act, and restricting abusive subprime loans. You know, there's a big agenda. You can't do it all in 1 year.
Next on Sea Change Radio, we look back at a 2009 discussion with the late Kenyan environmental activist, Nobel laureate Wangari Maathai.
One of the reasons that you started the Green Belt movement was because of the deforestation that had happened, and that deforestation was largely a result of the kind of governance or economic imperialism that had been seeded by the colonialism. In what ways was the Green Belt movement a response to that kind of imperialistic governance?
Yes, and as you said, that imperialistic government during the colonial period was adopted by our post-colonial administrators who did not appreciate the fact that the colonial administration was destroying the environment, was destroying the forests, was opening up land that should not have been opened up for agriculture and human settlements. And what we tried to do was to raise our voices against this, and the biggest disappointment for me personally is that one would have expected that once we became independent and once we began to manage our own resources and our own affairs, we would be more responsible and we would be more accountable and we would be more concerned about the welfare of the people. But those who assumed leadership nearly forgot all the commitments they had promised the people. And as the people looked up to them, they just went on with a lot of greed, a lot of selfishness, a lot of dictatorial tendencies. And eventually we found ourselves not moving in the direction that we had hoped when we got independence. And eventually we realized that it doesn't matter. Most people, once they are in power, they need to be regulated, they need to be controlled, they need institutions that will make sure that they do not exploit these resources at the expense of the common good. And these are some of the issues that we have been trying to pass all these years.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. Now let's turn to the early days of my tenure as host of Sea Change Radio with this peek into a 2010 conversation I had with environmentalist and author Bill McKibben.
You wrote that corporations are like single-celled flagellates. And it seems to me that this simplicity of the corporation itself leads us, you know, their simplicity of just profits, that's what their mandates are. The simplicity of that idea itself can really get us into trouble when we start encountering these more complex ideas like how to stop the planet from overheating.
Well, I agree with you. I mean, look, the major coal, gas, and oil companies now have about five times as much carbon in their reserves as the scientists say is safe to burn if we have any chance of staying below 2 degrees Celsius increase in temperature. you know, every one of their instincts calls for them to go ahead and burn that oil, that coal, that gas. And the only way they'll won't do it is if we stop them from doing it. There's nothing self-limiting in their behavior in that way, the way that there is in human beings. We need a price on carbon to steer them in the correct directions. You know, Exxon's perfectly capable of being an energy company instead of an oil company, and of making probably large, even obscene amounts of money putting up solar panels or windmills or whatever it is. But we need public policy that steers them in that direction, and at the moment we can't get it because their political power is so strong that it blocks every approach.
Before he became a fixture on CNN, Van Jones was better known as a leading green jobs advocate. Here in this 2010 interview, I speak to him about how vital it is for countries to set forth policies that support and bolster the renewable energy space.
So you think it's really a niche of our big business community that's setting us back, it sounds like. I mean, there are big corporations in Europe, of course, and many of them do a lot of business in the U.S., and while we get our news and information from an American perspective, of course, you really don't hear as much from the European climate change battle about a dichotomy between what's generally accepted as the right thing to do and profits.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're 100% right. I mean, my basic view is that the vast majority of the business community in this country is for American leadership and being innovative, being entrepreneurial. There's nothing innovative about using this, you know, these century-old, you know, pollution-based fossil fuels. And, you know, you got a planet now, 6 billion, soon to be 9 billion people. All of them are going to want, you know, a car, a refrigerator, an iPod. It's clear whatever country figures out a way to diversify its energy portfolio and export clean energy products as opposed to importing dirty energy is gonna be a leader and going to make a huge contribution. That's what Americans want to do. Most of the business community just says, give us certainty, give us regulatory certainty, and we'll make the investments and we'll do the inventions and we'll do the innovation, we'll figure it out. The problem is you've got a small section of self-interested actors who keep throwing marbles on the stairs, banana peels on the sidewalk, and doing everything that they can to prevent us from actually acting as one country in the face of this huge energy and environmental challenge. And as long as Americans put up with that, we're going to continue to fall behind, you know, Asia and Europe on technologies that we developed. You know, the American taxpayer put the money on the table to invent solar panels and to invent wind turbines and to invent smart batteries and to invent a bunch of this stuff. And now European and Asian companies, God bless them, are taking up those technologies and beating us to death with them by having a better regulatory and policy environment for their entrepreneurs.
Do you remember when we first met? I sure do. It was sometime in early September. Well, you were lazy about it. You made me wait around. I was so crazy about you, I didn't mind. So I was late for class. I locked my back to yours. It wasn't hard to find. You painted flowers on me. Guess that I was afraid that if you rolled over, you might not roll back my direction real soon. Well, I was crazy about you then and now, but the craziest thing of all, over 10 years have gone by, you're still mine. We're locked in time. Let's rewind.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. To celebrate our 10th anniversary, we're taking a look back this week at some of the best moments of the first 5 years of the show. Don't forget, you can listen to all of these interviews in their entirety for free in our online archives. Next, you'll hear me talking to famed documentary filmmaker Ken Burns about his film The Dust Bowl and what it reveals about modern industrial agricultural practices.
from a policy standpoint. Wheat gluts are still occurring on an annual basis around the world. What kind of lessons do you think we could have learned better, and what worked and what didn't work during to get us out of the Dust Bowl?
Well, I think the first and foremost lesson has less to do with wheat than to just the human folly to go in there and plant it. Yes, we do have wheat gluts. We did have wheat gluts then. We sometimes have wheat gluts now in various places. But we also have, because of drought, tremendous shortages. And the real problem facing the human race is that we're going to run out of stuff. And we have to figure out how to plan long term, which we're not very good at doing. We want to live in the moment. A good deal of the agriculture in the United States has been taken over by agribusiness. They're more interested in, you know, the judging me quarter to quarter, the shareholder value, and making profits, than they are with what is harming the environment, what chemicals may be detrimental, what genetically modified foods might be ultimately harmful, and not just expedient in the long term. So I think what we need is a much more organic relationship to the landscape, and much more sustainable, so that we can make sure that our children and our grandchildren have enough to eat, enough to drink, and air that has a quality that's worth breathing.
One of my favorite people to speak with over the years has been author Steve Almond. Never one to hold back, in this discussion from October 2012, Almond tells us what's really on his mind.
So, getting back to the climate science denial issue, it seems like the big concession from the right is now, okay, climate change exists, but are we causing it? Is this really progress at all, though, Steve?
It's just not a discussion that's an adult discussion. The adult discussion is, okay, we're going to destroy our habitat if we don't make fundamental changes in the way that we live. We're just going to do that. And the sadistic thing about it, you know, when I before I was a parent, I didn't worry about it, because people who are in their 30s and 40s and 50s will coast by. We'll just catch the very end of peak oil. We'll keep squeezing the rocks and doing whatever we have to, and offloading the environmental ruin to places in the world that we don't have to face. When people die there, it doesn't matter, because they're not really fully human to us. They're an abstraction. They're the poor brown people who, in parentheses, in our own entitled first world way, probably deserve to be that way because they were unfortunate enough to not be born Americans. We're going to offload our environmental ruin into those places and continue to suck up their resources and heat up the planet, and we'll be fine. We can do that without inconveniencing ourselves for the next 30 years and probably be okay. Gas will get a little bit more expensive. We won't be able to fly as much, but we'll basically be all right. It's our kids who are sunk. It's our kids who are in real big trouble, because the entire basis of our economies and the global economy are founded on demonstrably disappearing resources that have a demonstrably disastrous effect on the habitat that is going to create untold havoc and ruin on the planet. And that's, I just trust scientists who say this, even though it's a difficult thing to look at and it's scary. That's what adults do. That's their job, is to sort of look out for the next generation.
So how do we kind of get out of that box that our world is the most important? It leads to this theory of what it is to be an American in the last few decades, it seems like.
Yeah, I mean, look, the crisis that I, as I see it, is that people's psychological and emotional pathologies are determining policy. Policy is sort of the larger moral decisions that we make as a collective. And when you have something that is manifest and apparent to people whose job it is to study it, and there are even people coming up with really good solutions to those common problems, what you do is you talk with those people and you make proposals. And at the expense of your own political capital, you put those forward to try to change the discussion and create examples of cities that are better off because they instituted public transportation, or an economy that's better off because it invests in sustainable energy, or a local economy that's better off because people are healthier, because they eat healthier food, because they grow more of it locally and it's less processed. And that's not something that happens overnight, but that's the world of ideas that I want being discussed, not this crap that lives on cable television.
As a fan of the Grateful Dead, I was delighted to interview the band's drummer, Bill Kreutzmann, for Sea Change Radio in 2011. Here, Kreutzmann talks about his time with the band and how drumming requires a little bit of schizophrenia.
So, there's a scene, which I just love, in the Grateful Dead movie, where you say,
Quote, I call myself a four-sided schizophrenic because you have to have four separate ideas going and then a single thing here. It's more than just patting your head and rubbing your stomach because you're doing it with four things. When you get that down, in music and drumming in particular, then you get so you can be dancing. And that is really fine because you sit back there and it feels just like you're dancing. You're playing and the groove is just right and the kicks aren't made, the accents and the rolls, they're not made. They're just into the flow, and that's the kind of music I like. So hearing you talk about dancing and drumming like dancing, what's in your life in Hawaii that most closely replicates that feeling?
This may surprise you, but it's gardening. I mean, I jam over here with wonderful musicians, but when I go out and I garden, I actually start moving around the garden like that. We have an organic garden here, of course, and it gives me such pleasure to be working with the earth and being able to do something right with the earth and be able to have the earth, it talks to me. And you ask any gardener out there, they'll say, yeah, the plants talk to you, you know, and it really does. And this is the thing it says. The earth says, thank you for doing the right thing with me. Instead of blowing the top off me to get coal or destroying me by digging these thousand, you know, mile deep holes in the ocean and the ocean floor to get oil, you're planting something that's giving back to me, and then I can feed you. So that's my new line to the foresight of schizophrenic. That line, by the way, was before I really understood what schizophrenic meant. But it just means that you do four separate things when you're playing drums. Like I'd have my right hand would be playing with the lead, would be playing with Jerry. My foot would be playing with whatever Phil was playing. The backbeat would be me. And then the other hand and stuff would, or foot would be with Bobby. So I'd roll it around like that. That's what I meant by that foresight of schizophrenic.
For the memory of candlelight and wine, castles on the Rhine, the Parthenon and Momentum, the Hudson River line. How lovely it was. Thanks for.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. We're celebrating the show's 10th anniversary this week with a look back at our first 5 years. Don't forget, you can listen to all of these interviews in their entirety for free via our online archives. Next, listen to a bit of my interview with Grateful Dead lyricist, environmentalist, and the founder of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, John Perry Barlow, who passed away earlier this year.
Well, your songs reflect a little, you can see the evolution in your thinking and being more proactive with environmental issues. Which led which in terms of, did you decide as the Grateful Dead became more and more popular that this was a great soapbox for you to get your messages across, or was it?
I tried never to preach with my songs anyway. You know, one of the things that.
But they became a little more explicit in terms of the messages.
It became a little more explicit and you know, in ways that, you know, actually embarrassed me slightly.
Like which ones?
Well, I wouldn't want to be specific, but I mean, I was trying to be more didactic than I think was a good idea. I mean, Bob Hunter and I realized sometime in the 70s that what seemed to be gathering itself naturally around the Grateful Dead was something that had many of the characteristics of a religion. And that made us uneasy. And then, you know, we thought about it some and then thought what really made us uneasy about religion was dogma. You know, in the capacity to have a belief system you could impose on somebody else. And if there was going to be dogma in the mysterious religion of the Deadheads, it was going to come most likely from our songs. So we were very scrupulous about not giving them the opportunity to form anything out of those songs, you know, and not being preachy and not having the substrate of a belief system that they could then develop that had some sort of authoritative point of reference.
And beyond SIVA and the Rainforest Action Network, there weren't a lot of overtly political positions from the band at all. Was that because of that?
Yeah. Our belief was all along, you know, I mean, there was a big schism in the counterculture as it developed in the 60s between the politicos and the acid heads. You know, the radicals over in Berkeley and the peace and love camp over in the Haight. And they didn't actually get along with each other very well at all. One of them completely lacked a sense of humor, for one thing. and they were authoritarian, and they, you know, they were already acting like the new boss, even though they weren't. But anyway, so I was never particularly didactic with my songwriting, and I had a growing set of beliefs about nature that were important to me. And, you know, and also in a spiritual sense, an awareness that everything is alive. To me, it is, and that there is something, holy about life. It's such a freakish development in the universe. It has this astonishing capacity to fly directly in the face of entropy.
And somehow that becomes preachy to some people, but it's reality.
It's demonstrable. If you start saying things about what life wants, besides more, you know, I mean, the motto of life, as far as I can tell, is more.
Right, you say in, is it We Can Run, the song?
We Can Run, but We Can't Hide, yeah.
Brad Midler, you say, we got everyone believing that more is more.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it isn't. You know, I mean, more, if everything is thinking more, 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 you know, it's a damn good thing that you know, in the complex interaction of all living things, there are other versions of more that your more is going to run up against, you know, and then there's a balance struck. That's why life works with these very simple algorithms operating, is because they run into each other and they balance out.
Now, to close out the show, let's listen to the great artist Ralph Steadman talk about his relationship with his longtime collaborator, Hunter S. Thompson.
The process of sitting down on and putting color on paper must have been a little different in the world of gonzo journalism.
I think I was just waiting for the prayer to be answered. I only went to America looking for work. And I got a call. He was the art director of Scanlan's magazine. But he was the man who contacted me. He said, how would I like to meet an ex-Hell's Angel who just shaved his head? And I said, okay, that'd be fine. That's a job, is it? Is this a job? And he said, yes, you got to go to Kentucky and meet. And it took 3 days before we met. We eventually met up in Kentucky at the Derby, as you call it, the Derby, we say. And in Louisville, and we, after 3 days, I heard a voice behind me, and it was Hunter. I turned around, and there's this bullet-headed character, 6'6", a huge guy, and he said, you Ralph Steadman? I said, yes. I said, okay, I'm Hunter S. Thompson. Hello. I wonder, maybe you should get a beer. So I said, okay, let's get a beer.
One of the things that was lost in the film experience, as opposed to sitting down and opening a book, was your illustrations and your touch. And I think it was inextricably linked to the Thompson-esque experience. What do you think the next generation might be missing by just learning about Hunter S. Thompson through film?
Well, they might miss the fact that right when I first met him, way all up a time ago, one of the first things he said to me was, I'd feel real trapped, Ralph, in this life if I didn't know I could commit suicide at any moment. That was in his mind all his life. He took out of life from the world just exactly something that a lot of people crave, and that is a touch of craziness, a touch of truth couched or clothed in craziness. He was a wonderful human being, really. He could be terrible, but he was wonderful. Crooked past once more. Sway the future to the past and find what will
endure. You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Samford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by the Dirty Dozen Brass Band, Jack Johnson, and Ella Fitzgerald.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.